So I want to say a few things at the beginning, and Stephen has a wonderful lineup of some things that are relevant to this week's themes, and there's a lot of cross-referencing. Jerry Rothenberg, for example, is coming next week. He's this masterful editor of ethnopoetics volumes and other great anthologies, Technicians of the Sacred, Shaking the Pumpkin, and other texts. We have some moments from a class he did on what is sometimes called ethnopoetics and beyond. And I want to again refer people, especially those who are going on with their Naropa studies, to this anthology, Civil Disobediences, which is a collection of transcriptions that have been edited and worked and so on, but from the archives. So this is a companion to a lot of the kinds of presentations that go on here. And for example, for this week's themes, I mean, there are many pieces that would be relevant. There's a translation panel with Anselm Hallo, who many of you just heard, and Kai Nieminen, who's a Finnish writer. There's Arthur Z, the Wang River poem series. There's a piece of his on translating that sequence. There's a piece by Ed Sanders, which is a tribute to Sappho. Sanders was himself a Greek scholar and student. And there's a brief history of the prose poem, which basically comes out of the French tradition by Cole Swenson. There's a Lorenzo Thomas piece to see and read through poetry, where he starts with, I believe it's Psalm 137, and how important that psalm was by the waters of Babylon, how important that was to the Black community through many, many centuries, especially under slavery. So just to highlight those texts, again, which would dovetail with the themes of this week. And maybe I'll wait till the end to play. I have a clip of Antonin Artaud, which is a recording that Clayton Eshelman brought to Naropa when he lectured on Artaud in the early 90s. So I think we can listen to that at the end. And in fact, Artaud is speaking in a gibberish, I mean, an imagined language, a sound language. Okay, so let's go to...
I have some comments on that lesson or something. Thanks, everybody. Okay, notes. So the week's themes are cultural activism, cross-cultural exploration of the language experience, your own backyard translation, preservation of various modes of prosody and cultural form, struggles of writers under difficult political regime, writer as antenna, the value of our work, and how does it connect across many kinds of borders. Things. Cultural activism relates to a writer as an antenna, which has multiple applications, many of which converge on the idea of writer as reader, reader of the news, of history and of philosophy, of science, researcher in various fields, also reader of conditions, writer as augur, A-U-G-U-R, augur. The augur was a religious official in Rome who foretold events by interpreting omens related to auros, increase, into English as augment and auspicious. The second element, garire, to talk, so perhaps to effect an increase in crops through ritual speech. Or a more popular line, augur derives from avis, bird, and refers to one who reads the flights of birds. Denis Levertov's grandfather was a rabbi reputed to understand the language of birds. To what extent, or in what ways, did the granddaughter inherit that capacity? Go and investigate that, please. Augury took place at a templum, a piece of ground consecrated for the taking of auspices. See contemplationem, act of looking at, contemplare, to observe, originally to mark out a place for observation, as does an augur. Writer as contemplator, addressed elsewhere. Writer as reader. Allen Ginsberg used to read the New York Times more or less daily, and he clipped stories related to a set of favorite themes, stories he was following long-term, compiling files, CIA dope, nukes, free speech issues, has been pointed out by Noam Chomsky and others. An isolated story in the Times on a drug bust might seem relatively innocuous, but if you collect and thread together every story of the international drug trade for a decade, you get a much more complete picture. A Yale graduate student in Southeast Asian history, Alfred W. McCoy, decided to investigate the international heroin trade and use down his files. He also visited various drug lords and officials in Southeast Asia and so on, and he read the 500-year history of hard drugs from opium down and concluded that narcotics traffic has always been, in one way or another, government business. And he drew quite a damning picture of CIA complicity in heroin traffic. This is not wacko conspiracy theory. It's a doctoral dissertation about wackos. McCoy, later a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, the book is called The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia. It's in the library. So there's that sense of the writer as antenna staying on the story until the big picture emerges. And that goes to investigative poetics mentioned earlier, Ed Sanders' method, where you pick a topic and learn everything you can about it, and the database that you accumulate informs your work for a period of time. You investigate the local power company, and the data generate a screenplay, a long poem, an essay, maybe all three. Writer is mind reader. We have billions of synaptic connections. The old sutras say something like 100,000 seed thoughts in the blink of an eye. If you watch your mind, you get better at catching them. You get more of what's going on. So there are channels that are normally dismissed in the course of goal-driven thought. This is pure crackpot speculation now, but say there are channels that don't get discarded so readily in a state of non-goal-oriented contemplation, meditation, or I would argue, writing. The master artist, like the meditation master, catches more of what's going on, more of consciousness at the level of pure potential, before we force the various vectors into an old-established pattern, a neurosis, or a cliché. That's the playfulness of poesis in the raw state. It takes the patterns apart. Ginsberg used to say, "What were you thinking before you thought you were writing a poem?" Writers trouble establish patterns. We talked about that the other day. That's your activism. And I want to play a sample of from Joan Retallack talking about changing the cultural climate as a life project.
Knowing what it contains,
knowing
what complex world that we live in, to not think in terms of isolated, heroic acts of social agency, but to think in terms of projects, of cumulative effects over time. Actually, Kevin and Dodie and I were talking about this yesterday. But it's your whole life project as an artist and or as a poet that is going to, in some way, affect the culture around you, the cultural climate around you. And in changing the cultural climate in one way or another, then very specific things that have to do with dire social problems may become more possible. And that's a contribution. You may never be able to draw an arrow from this poem to that person being released from jail or that person being acknowledged in their full humanity. But you might say that the ethos of the culture was affected by the sum total of what I think of as poetical projects at any given time. And they always are. I mean, I think we're really at the mercy of the sum total of people who choose to consider the values that their work comes out of, and to consider that in terms of community and care about others. And that right now, we can consider that in our extreme electronic intimacy with the rest of the planet in a very broad way that wasn't possible before this, and I think is wonderful if we're not overwhelmed by that possibility.
That's Joan Retallack from 2002. When I was a music student in college, we had this maestro, a composer, we were all in awe of him. He said that the musicians were going to save the world. It was quite serious. Another teacher, equally strange and gifted, asked rhetorically, "What do you need to know in order to be a musician?" And he said, "It's everything." We might dismiss these as romantic ideas, a kind of bourgeois inflation, but that would be a mistake, I think. It's a grandiose romance that might turn out to be correct. What if Bodhisattva is a workable metaphor for what I am? The question is more interesting than any grim dismissal. I mean, there's old Richard Coeur de Lion, held hostage in Austria in 1192. And he writes a song about his miserable state. Oh, woe is me, my friends are not rich enough to bail me out, they're blotting me off. He couldn't know that 900 years later, what we call troubadour poetry would inspire a bunch of Yankee bookworms to begin to chant again. So here's Jerome Rauffenberg on renewal as rediscovery. And some note on ethnopoetics, a term I believe he coined in 1968 during collaboration with the anthropologist Dennis Tedlock on broadening the sense of literature, broadening the sense of poetics, and also how to notate people's speech by making use of the space of the page is actually part of the practices. So here's Jerry.
This is the last panel, 25th anniversary of the final answer. To that, although you notice the prior answer is not even the prior answer, because I would answer everything that he's asking to answer. The question has a special relevance for me, I suppose, since I've long been engaged in a project that involves an interplay of very new and very old forms of languaging and representation. I think that one of the principal allures of poetry, even, or maybe especially, the most of our most so-called experimental poets, has been the sense of engaging in a process, a way of thinking and saying, that has until very recently been universal both in space and time. The time factor is a measure of its oldness and the emergence of a new poetry, not just a new America, the emergence of a new poetry span out, new poetry over the globe, over the last 100 or 200 years, has almost always been accompanied by declarations of recovery, rediscovery at the heart of every new invention. This is clear enough in US poetry, where someone like Ezra Pound, whom we take as radical, structurally radical from the cantos on, insists on pushing the time frame back and expanding it horizontally or culturally to a range of earlier initiating moments. First, Anglo-Saxon rhythms merged with Homeric shaman journeys down among the shades in Canto 1, then in his other and his later writings with the Chinese Book of Songs, the African Desir's mood is given by Frobenius, erotic poems of ancient Egypt, recastings of neglected Provençal and Roman poets. This was what put him in conflict with the Italian futurist Marinetti, a tale of the tribe, as he, as Pound, named it, but curiously, in that fascist mind, a greater tribe than privileged race and nation might have led us to expect. The same spirit of newness and transformation with relation to the past and present, what I used to speak of as an ongoing attempt to reinterpret the poetic past from the point of view of the present, infused the work of many of us in post-World War II America. Olson, Duncan, Snyder, Kelly, Waldman, Schwerner, among the major ones from my perspective. And there were others too, outside the US as such. Tsara with his projected gathering of African and South Pacific poems, the surrealists who set up a bureau under Antonin Artaud of research aimed in that direction, and the French negritude poets and their counterparts in the Spanish New World. All of this and more was the underlying basis for what I came to call ethnopoetics, and it encouraged me and others to declare that a poetics without an accompanying ethnopoetics was not capable of engaging the full possibility of poetry that our time allowed us. The Russian futurists, as contrasted to the Italian, are probably
Long time poet, anthologist, and translator, and I'm glad he was coming.
He was able to, he created these almost maps and family trees, and I recommend the Poems for the Millennium, his most recent anthology, which is 2 volumes, and it can really feed me for forever. And I think he's able to link you know, lit the work of the modernists as he does here, talking of using Pound, of course, is a great example. Pound's translations were not that accurate, really, and people have gone back and done more literal translations. But he translated them in a way that brought, I mean, they're the Cathay, for example, Cathay, or the famous poem everybody knows, The River Merchant's Wife, a letter. I mean, do people still encounter that in high school? And good, okay. But I mean, that's a very powerful piece. I mean, it's a hit of Chinese poetry of a particular time. And so in his investigation into the troubadours, his books on the poetics of the troubadours, his use of, as Jerry says, the Anglo-Saxon in that first canto in his own cantos, I think is a, you know, it was a kind of radical, we talk in Europe a lot about recovery or rediscovery or keeping things unburied, and that was actually the push of what he was doing. So in that spirit.
So, to know everything is, of course, hardly possible. But you can know a lot. And what qualifies as everything varies from person to person. That's the division of labor, the necessity for communities of knowers. It's a movable feast, and you've got to move. You know, you've got to move. There's a global housing crisis. You've got to move. Defy borders. That's another topic that comes up. Border crossing comes up a lot lately in art criticism and literary theory, in the academy in general, and it's discussed in multiple senses, and is current in the most basic sense of a breakdown between what used to be distinct fields of inquiry. We live in a time of, to take another aspect, we live in a time of unprecedented levels of migration. There are more bicultural people, more people between states in the world today than there have ever been before. There are 2 to 3 million Iraqi refugees in Syria and Jordan. Another 2 million, the ones who can't afford to get out, are internal refugees adrift. 1 out of 6 Iraqis is displaced. Where's the border in that scenario? The more they insist on it, the more it collapses. If a nation implodes, where is the border? The nation, the idea of the nation, the ethnos, the people. 30 years ago, Julia Kristeva wrote, "The nation, which was the dream and the reality of the 19th century, seems to have reached both its peak and its limit with the 1929 crash and the National Socialist apocalypse, the Nazi regime. We have witnessed the destruction of its very foundation, economic homogeneity, historical tradition, and linguistic unity. World War II, which was fought in the name of national values, brought an end to a reality of the nation, which it turned into a mere illusion that has been preserved for ideological or strictly political purposes. The idea of the nation state as a kind of useful illusion is taken up by historian and critic Christopher Lash in his last book, The Revolt of the Elites and the Betrayal of Democracy. He argued that meritocracy, selective elevation of individuals into the capitalist elite, has replaced the American democratic ideal. These elites are mobile, global in outlook, increasingly offshore, and transnational in their allegiances. They identify more as global individuals than as Americans, retaining the flag-waving as a kind of religion for the suckers whom they have duped, divided, betrayed, and abandoned. Welcome to Home Depot. Boundary breakdown is taken up on another level, famously by Donna Haraway in her Manifesto for Cyborgs, all distinctions between animal and human, organism and machine have broken down. Then there are syncretisms from syncretismos, union of communities, two traditions blend to make a third. The demigods of West Africa follow the slave ships across the Middle Passage to Haiti, where Christian saints and icons blend with African ways. Culture. I'll just do a couple of words on culture. I want to put some Mary Baraka in that connection too. Culture, a few words on culture. Raymond Williams says it is one of the 2 or 3 most complicated words in the English language. The term is related at its origins to tending something, crops, hence cultivation. Also to inhabit something, hence colony. Also to worship, hence cult. From the 16th century, human development, the culture of mind. In the 18th century, the term assumes class associations, as in the cultivated person. In the 1780s, Herder attacked the assumption that human culture in the sense of the historical development of humanity was a unilinear process leading to the dominance of European culture. He said, the very thought of a superior European culture is a blatant insult to the majesty of nature. 200 years later, we are still dealing with this. Alan Bloom, writing in the 1980s, saying things like, just because there are different cultures doesn't mean that one is not superior to others. Here's a few minutes of Amiri Baraka speaking in 1985. So it's a little, he switches around, he says a lot of good stuff.
Tilled fields, culture, tilled fields.
First of all, we're going to have a second part of the class. We're going to have a good opportunity. A brother named David Nelson, who was with me last night, who was one of the founders of The Last Poets. I don't know if some of you know The Last Poets, but let's say they are at least the fathers of the rappers, you know, this generation. And he's now gotten a group together in Denver. They're going to come here and give you a half hour or so for us in the class to sort of, pick up things so we don't get too academic. Now, the only things that I have that by way of texts, and I've got 5 of these Black Nation magazines, I've got about 15 of these in the traditions, and we're going to be using those for people who don't have the bread to pay for those. We have photocopy the, printed sections of the stuff. But if you're interested in the thing, there it is. If you're interested in the photocopies, Mary has it. And the reason that we want to do that is there's a couple of things. In this issue of Black Nation, which I edit, there's a whole section of focus on the Caribbean. There is a section on the dub poets. I don't know if you all know the dub poets of Jamaica, Trinidad, who now live in England, many of them, and who have started a poetry that's a poetry based on reggae music, reggae rhythm. And texts of their poetry is in this book, some of the poetry, and interviews with some of the leading ones of the dub poets. Dub because, like a record dub, they began by playing with disc jockeys, accompanying disc jockeys on the radio. The disc jockeys would play the records, and they would, rap along with the records. They would actually begin to recite with the records, and that's how that whole poetic tradition started. This other thing is a copy of a poem of mine came out in 1980 called In a Tradition. And the reason that I want to talk about this later on is that there are a lot of names in here that I think most of you would probably never come upon otherwise. And I'm saying that because if you go to American universities, American University is pretty much an extension of what the society is, so by and large they're racist, so that means you would never find out about most of the people on the planet. Like most of the poetry on the planet, you would never know anything about. Most of the art on the planet, you would never know anything about.
So the names in this book,
that's what they are, simply names. I mean, it's in a poem, but we're going to extract these names later. And we want to talk about all these people. Who are these people? Do you know these people? If we say Miles Davis, well, most of you know Miles Davis. That's not mystery any longer. But beginning with that idea, that there are a lot of people, a lot of information out there that you don't know. And the problem with American universities is that they do not, the quicker you actually be intellectuals, simply show this. And if you really get to that conclusion, if you can understand that, that an intellectual is somebody who tries to understand what the whole world's output, and who they are in the context of the whole world. You understand what I'm saying? In other words, you cannot understand. There's no reason for you to say Beethoven is great if you don't know anything about Duke Ellington.
That was Duke Ellington. There's no reason. You can't say Beethoven is great if you don't know about Duke Ellington. You can't make that judgment. It goes back to knowing everything. So the sense of culture, to go back to this etymology, the sense of culture is self-improvement through prayer, or cultivated taste carries over in the late 19th century, such that culture means the best that has been thought, produced, or created. However, was it Matthew Arnold formulated what we might call high culture, the exposure to which is supposed to elevate the great mass of the benighted? Once again, exposure to the superior European is supposed to enlighten the savages. At the same time, there's an emergent use in anthropology that is broader and refers to a whole way of life of a particular people. One of the problems with culture in this sense is that it's difficult to distinguish one from another. I mean, if two tribes are neighbors and they speak different dialects, but their pots and marriage customs all look the same, are they two cultures or one? This is why in the early days of ethnographic field research, the best place to go do your work was thought to be an island. Like, grab the islands before they're all gone, because after the islands it gets much more difficult. As if that would delineate one culture from another. After they grabbed all the islands, then they grabbed the peninsulas. Hopefully you can get a peninsula with mountains at the top. The problem there is that island folk tend to have canoes. They go off island to island, trade with other people, sometimes over vast expanses of sea. So does the island still contain the culture? Or is it contained only in the ethnography? My better half is an arts administrator, a curator, producer of performance and visual arts, says that where the really interesting work is coming from these days is Asia, Africa, the places that cross over, the Caribbean, the African, and the Americas, the First Nations, Oceania, all those people who up until recently were considered not to make real art. You know that, when Europeans make art, everybody else makes folk stuff, or religious stuff. This sort of thinking is curiously persistent. Henry Louis Gates discusses this in his book, Signifying Monkey. The 18th century, the European art academies were concerned with arriving at a rational aesthetics. As in any problem of identity or language or system, you define something by what it is not. Identity occurs in a system of difference. So arriving at a rational theory of art in the 1700s meant identifying what rational art was not. There's some feedback here. I could speak up if you want. What it was not was the art of the European peasantry. Peasants make things that are utilitarian, decorative, charged with superstition, etc. But high art, real art, didn't do any of those things. Art is about beauty, not utility. In the middle 1800s, Théophile Gautier writes that utility is not the measure of beauty, because if that were the case, the toilet would be the most beautiful object in the house. Now, this is art for art's sake, which I'm not finished with yet, I'm not dismissing it. It's come back later. The point for the moment is that as European political sway moved outward, the arts of the Middle East, India, Asia, Oceania were characterized using the vocabulary developed to deal with European peasant art. Seen one savage, you've seen them all. They're all the same. They're not us. And this is, I'll play a little bit of Victor Hernandez Cruz speaking on a translation panel in 1998. Victor Hernandez Cruz is a Puerto Rican poet. And a great scholar and a great performer of his work.
Next trip. Well, let me start off. I guess you know who Christopher Columbus is. Well, in Spanish, it's Cristóbal Colón, and he has a lot more pitfalls. And actually, Christopher Columbus, Colón, he was present in Granada, which was the last stronghold of the Arabs, of the Moors, when they, which were in Spain for over 700 years. So when that ceremony to give the keys back to the Christians went down, he was in the audience, but of course he had been after Isabel to get her to finance a voyage that he wanted to take to some unknown lands across the sea somewhere. So he gets a translator. For a translator, he gets a converted Jew who was fluent in Arabic. And I suppose this is the language that he thought more than likely that he would run into, or something that will have those kinds of sound effects. So they come with this translator to this part of the world, and at a certain point in Cuba, he gets off to greet the Cuban chieftain, and I'll tell you his name in the context of the story. and brother, his name is Kuana Khan, and the name of Kuwa is Kuana Khan. So he first is translated to all Greek, but Taino is Arawak now, Arawak chieftain, and Taino chieftain, and comes along with his translator, but it's supposed to be Jewish, Yiddish, or whatever, Hebrew, and Arabic to confront the man that speaks, who's half nude there speaking in Arabic. And then somewhere in this dialogue, back and forth, well, the chief of things is they're trying to ask him, well, what man is this? And well, he said, this is Kuana Khan. And Christopher Columbus heard Genghis Khan. So the origins of, at least of our Americas, of our Latin America, is in a linguistic, based on a linguistic mistake. These are geographic distortions. And I've always found that to be very interesting. So there are Indios without India. And Indios got tagged, everybody's Indio. Regardless from the people, they call Eskimos Indian sometimes, and they call all the way to all the native peoples in Argentina. But we know specifically that different people had different names for their spaces and different names with which they identified themselves. The first places to make this contact with the Spanish, as you know, was the Caribbean. And the first European development was Santo Domingo. And the second one was the area of San Juan. And Havana is the third one. And then there's the motion San Agustin to go to Florida. And this is the beginnings of this new world, which was totally mispronounced. Everything was mispronounced, and everything was based on this original linguistic mistake.
Okay, Dr. Cruz, Caribbean as a linguistic mistake. Should I go on? Should we take questions? Go on a little bit? Okay, so the question of cross-cultural work, to what extent it brings up the problematic questions. To what extent, for example, are the old ideas of the superiority of European culture at play if I take up Bolivian mountain music or Ghanaian drumming, or if I translate Inuit poetry? This becomes very complicated. Some people who have worked in translation have stopped doing it because of the issues, the accusations of co-optation, but then you have the problem of isolation. For example, if none of the hunkies in the State Department study Arabic because it's become not politically correct to do so, we are in some deep shit. I think it comes down to specific cases and a sense of respect, and you always have to look at the power relations. Colonialism is still with us, as it's what musical anthropologist Alan Lomax used to call cultural grayout. Do I want to participate in that? Personally, I have tried to take the advice I heard when I was 18, when Cecil Taylor visited my school, the great jazz pianist Cecil Taylor. He said, you have to get back to your roots. He said it over and over again. He took questions at the end of a recital, and every question that was asked, he had the same answer. You've got to get back to your roots. And I took that seriously. so to me, that means I'm not going to present myself as a player of Ugandan marimba music or a singer of Kiowa songs. Does it mean that I'm not going to play jazz? That's a little more complicated. Jazz is syncretic music, and one major stream in that blend came from my native turf. Still, early on, Cecil's advice turned that stream off for me as a practitioner, something I regret to some extent. What about rock and roll? Sorry, can't stop that. If pressed on the issue of roots, I'll invoke an Irish great-grandmother and claim allegiance to the original colonized savage. Come on, little baby, we got chicken in my bum. And when I hit anthropology classes in grad school in the early 90s, issues of colonialism and cultural appropriation were hot, if anthropology can be said to conduct heat. The discipline, which is relatively young as these things go, had just hit 100 or so, old enough for the grandchildren to start looking at the field critically, and there's now a substantial body of literature concerning the connections between, say, English ethnographic work in India and Africa in the colonial period and military administrative authorities. Anthropology wasn't all policing and pillage, though. It's not that simple. And there's a whole semester in that. Well, what am I to do? Well, I have to be critical of the various positions involved, particularly my own, critical in the sense of thinking in a crisis, criticism and crisis to a root, which has to do with judgment. You have to judge your own position in the spirit of justice. best critical take on ethnography that I know, or the most succinct take on ethnography, the one I like the best, as a short sort of pithy statement. Ethnography writing about other people or other nations, the best take on that comes from Trinh Thi Minh Ha, the Vietnamese American filmmaker. She says, ethnography is gossip, a conversation between two people about an absent other. This is sort of useful to keep in mind. It's akin to the idea that ethnography is pornography. And I got this from, when I first saw this, I was kind of outraged, and then I sort of studied it and thought about the problem, and I kind of see the point. It's Bill Nichols' work on documentary film. I don't have the book at hand. I went into a filmmaker friend, and she never returned it because it makes her hot. Sorry, I'm just kidding. But I think it's about others. It's a sense of voyeurism. You know, we get to watch the intimate activities of others who can't see us. To move to, I'll finish with this, and this may not be old hat, but if it's old hat, it's good old hat. To move to the larger idea of different cultures, there's the curious history whereby we have defined ourselves in reference to a despised or worshipped other. You know, that's two sides of the same coin. John Lennon was shot by a fan. Edward Said took this ambivalent mess up in 1979 in his book Orientalism, which everyone should read. It's very important that you read that book. If it's all news, don't be bored, just read it. I said that the Art Academy defined an aesthetic in opposition to that which was not the case. Said says that Europe was defined by not being an Orient. The East became, in a sense, the West is unconscious, the whole constellation of things we repress in order to be a person within the terms of our culture. That which is repressed is desire, also hatred, which is the flip side of the desire. Said talks about Flaubert's account of a knight with a dancer in Egypt. She's everything the Western woman isn't. She stands in for half the planet. The other half, the half that you want to welcome you with flowers, as was supposed to happen with the present difficulty in Iraq, and whom you want to control, to defeat, in the schizoid sadomasochism of the Western elites. There's a reason why Malcolm McLaren was able to make a fashion item of bondage pants. All those wicked nannies are the backbone of the empire. The ambivalent fascination with the other is not a purely Western phenomenon, of course. There are conversations all over the world in a multitude of languages about barbarians. You're in Rome, and you ask for bread before you have the pasta, and you are obviously a barbarian. The barbarian American is a well-known the world over. But when you factor in power relations, the U.S. in particular is to be scrutinized now, also because it is us, all of us, to some extent, because we are here in the seat of the new empire. That's our job.
Most of you, I think, know about the great, mad, visionary Theater in its Double. It's the book I recommend if you haven't read Artaud. He was doing investigative work, afflicted by this Orientalism. He had encountered Balinese dance troupes and musicians who came to Paris, who influenced Debussy and others, and wrote, he investigated Balinese trans performance. He also lived in the Tarahumara Indians and took the something like ayahuasca, and so is exploring these altered states as an artist. Okay.
My name is Linda, I'm the architect. And I have a question that probably doesn't have an answer, really, or multitude of answers, but my question is, when you're talking about literature and music and such from other cultures, why are there not more anthropologists and critics and translators that are from that culture translating that culture? Like, why does it seem that people come from outside to look at a culture and then, because of course you're going to have the distortion when you're coming from one culture and looking at another through that lens. Why is there not more, internal people that are in the culture looking through that culture's lens and then explaining it in a sense to other people?
The history of colonialism, exploitation of third world patriarchy, masculine dominated academy, but now increasingly, the people are doing work. My roommate, when I was in grad school, was a Matengo tribesman from Tanzania who was working on the musical zone people. So it's happening.
Do you have any just kind of suggestions as far as readings of people that are doing that kind of thing?
Well, you'd have to look within each culture and field and area. And I know, for example, that there's so much attention to Mayan, unlocking the hieroglyphs and a lot of Western Mayan scholars, but now that there's more education, Mayan can go into English or Spanish or French, and there are people within the culture now doing a lot of the research, and there have been these conferences that happened down there. I think that's important, that the discussion is happening at the sites of origin. But my sense is some of that is shifting, and what Stephen was saying about the way it's been, colonialism.
The first group, sort of non-marginalized, non-minority, that got into this was when women started doing this kind of work in larger numbers. But something came to mind. In my field, in order to answer your question, what I would do is I would go to the Society of Ethnomusicology, because I'm an ethnomusicologist, or go to the American Anthropological Association, go to their membership directory, and those things tend to be listed. I know in ethnomusicology, it's listed according to field of interest. So let's say you were interested in this, right? Go to who's working in Kenya and look up the names and find out. That's how I would do it.
Okay. All right.
Another example is Allison Hedge Cope and Sherman Mitsui have been going to Medellin. There's a festival there, and then working with indigenous people there. And as he was speaking the other day, translating into Spanish being the common language, but how they are working to make translations of indigenous writers more available. So, my view is that there's so much work to be done, and just start investigating that. Alice was actually saying earlier that she's finding resonance in her language with Quechua. So.
I had a question, or more something to bring up for discussion. In different cultures, it's easier, for us to access dance and music and art, visual arts, and just bring up the problem of literature and poetry. We have to either have a translation of that or learn the language, and so I don't know if you could discuss that a little and how that is just a barrier almost. And we can, if you study art, you can look at Chinese art or you can look at African art the same way you would look at American art, and in a sense, depending on lyrics with music and dance as well, and so that puts literature and writing on a completely different level of trying to.
There's still something about often if you're studying the dance and music about participating in that. And I know when we started Naropa, the view was to have study abroad programs in sacred world cultures and primarily Asia, because that seemed to be resonant with some of the vision behind the founding of the school and so on. But so when we go to Indonesia, we would be based in Bali. We'd actually study, carve masks and study, do the dancing ourselves and play the music, learn gamelan as it's taught there, which is completely orally. And even some of the text, you know, so maybe to shift the paradigm away from the book and the reading and the kind of intellectual, this was sort of an argument among some of the faculty even, who, you know, there's this emphasis, we're in an American school, we have to have, you know, the mission statement, it's all got to be tied to the language, and there was a wonderful anthropologist here in the early years who had a very different view, wanted to go back into learning in this more oral way. So I think, you know, in studying dance and music, there's another kind of very deep way to go. I mean, the writing, the language seems so difficult. I understand that. My friend Daniel Alcala is saying he doesn't even want to translate anymore for people. He wants people to go and learn those languages on their own. I mean, it's huge. It's huge. I think there are different views on that. I think there are ways you can get... Is there any language that you're sort of drawn toward?
I go to art school, and so we study a lot of art history. And so it just seems like in that, if you learn the language of art history, it's kind of almost universal. You can look at art from a different country, and it doesn't seem... I mean, you would obviously have to learn about their culture in context to their art, but it seems like language is just a huge barrier.
I mean, yeah, I'm learning languages that I'm interested in and exploring literature if there's languages, but it seems like I can go because I've learned so much about looking at art, I can go to myriad countries and explore the art and not have to not have that barrier. I often recommend to my students, you know, when they're talking about getting the writing degree, I say, you know, don't get your writing degree and then go get a PhD in English. Get your writing degree and then go get a PhD in anthropology or something, you know, some other comparative literature, so really get to it, really learn something about other people. You know, there was a guy I was in school with who, this is just a great story, I'll take 10 seconds. He'd gone to Japan, he graduated college, he didn't know what to do, he went to Japan, became a teacher of English, became fluent in Japanese, he got interested in Japanese high cuisine. He loved it. And he realized it was somewhat endangered, there was encroachment, and the Japanese high cuisine was becoming less practiced. Got himself a scholarship to go to Brown University for a free ride, where he got he did classes in anthropology, and then he got money to go back to Japan and be like a king and write a book. It's a creative grad school. There's a lot of work to be done there.
I was just gonna say.
Also, I think because we're out of the habit of the language, I mean, the language, it seems like more of a barrier than maybe it would have been, you know, in some other way that education evolved. I know in this town, they have Spanish. I mean, you can, at a very early age, be taking classes in Spanish. But it took, you know, people in the community fighting for that for their, you know, within the public school system.
Hi, Anna. So you brought up something that was really interesting to me, Stephen. This is kind of loud. Okay. About how we're in a time where more people are sort of in between states, and it's in a sense a sort of liminal time, and borders and boundaries are breaking down in lots of ways. But in another sense, it seems to be like a highly fragmented, highly specialized sort of postmodern mood. And there's a tension, I think, in those two states of being, I guess. And just thinking about like people like Donna Haraway, and we're talking about border boundary breakdowns, and thinking about culture as sometimes like false categorizations and ways that you can sort of synthesize thoughts about culture too. And I don't really know where my question is and all that, but.
What comes to mind for me is that I think that when old modes of thinking are threatened, they become entrenched. So, you know, on the one hand, the reality of the situation, I'm not an expert, and you can contradict me, please, if you know better. The reality of the situation is that U.S. foreign policy, U.S. foreign policy, which forces unrealistically low prices for corn, soybeans, and wheat, so that my kid can get fat on Twinkies, also puts 2 million Mexican farmers out of business. Now, when you have 2 million people south of the border whose business is farming, and what they know how to do is take care of crops, and you take them off their land, where are they going to go? So there's this disconnect between what we're doing to those people and what those people are resorting to in order to survive, you know? So there's this insistence on these soundbite, 10-second, ideologically driven, jargon-driven generalizations that do not take into account real conditions in the world today. And so this, when Kristeva is writing in 1972 about borders, about the nation-state having become obsolete with World War II, that's visionary in a way. That's starting to happen. Marx was talking about this in the 1850s. If you have capitalism, you have a global economy. Globalization is not like a 10-year-old concept. It goes back to the 1840s. So it's like this unrealistic, paradoxical insistence on that which is not the case. Yes, thanks.
Brendan Hamilton. Just wanted to thank Stephen and Ann. My question is directed toward the whole idea of like cultural hierarchies that we have in our heads, and I was just wondering like how we can try to avoid Western-minded cultural hierarchies without supplanting them with new hierarchies that seek to aggrandize other cultures that we think we understand while simultaneously dismissing other Americans as a bunch of dumb rednecks. This is coming from the fear that I have that a lot of progressive, educated, suburban or urban Americans that I know, middle class, are dismissive of a lot of working class Americans while at the same time they're attempting to embrace other cultures. How do we avoid that level of hypocrisy and get away from a Western-minded sense of cultural hierarchy without supplanting it with a new one?
Unqualified compassion.
Yeah, I'm curious about, you know, an example from your, I mean, do you feel that people are, this is in a danger in the people you spend time with or in your, I don't know what community you're coming from? Like?
I mean, I'm not like a huge country music fan, but I was having a conversation with a friend of mine last night, and he just starts making blanket statements about it and about like middle America and, you know, rednecks and, you know, how the rest of America is a bunch of
listen to the music
dumbasses. Yeah, and
listen,
he doesn't, he's from a prep school and thinks that he's better educated and knows better about the world than everybody else.
I love country music.
Carter family.
Pay attention to the minute particulars. What is it? Pay attention to
the little ones. Look at the minute particulars. That's from William Blake.
The people who generalization is something you got to watch out for. The general good is the clear good of the scoundrel. So people are making these sweeping generalizations. That's the political problem right now. When these guys get up on the news for 5 seconds and make some huge generalization, everybody's just supposed to accept. And that's the problem really of the left, is that the left tends to want to discuss things in detail and people don't want to know in detail. It's a real problem. You just have to be kind. The other answer is quickly is, that's something I spoke to the last time, the notion of the organic intellectual, that you do your work wherever you are. For example, I don't know about the problem. I don't know about if the farmers don't get it. I tend to think the farmers get it. You know, I think they really know what's happening. But in my world, I get to talk to 50 younger people 3 times a week, and I do that for 10 years. Now there's been about 700 or 800 people who have been through my classes. Some of them are going to be school teachers. Some of them are going to take some of what I have learned from my teachers with them, and that's where it goes. My kids are teaching kindergarten now. You know, my kids are teaching college now. So that's my hope, and that's my way of working.
No, that's, I would agree with that, and I mean, I remember when we first started this program, and the founder was saying, you know, you all have to be teachers in some way. I mean, you can take that in a number of ways. It doesn't mean within, you know, these regular institutional systems, but just that that's in your, that you will carry on something, and I feel the same way. I mean, I've had so many phenomenal teachers, and continue to have teachers. I mean, this situation here, all these people who have come here and lectured to us and read to us and spoken and interacted with us are all my teachers as well, and as are the students. So, you know, just shift, it's the bodhisattva thing Stephen was saying, bringing up. I mean, that's a view, rather than see that as some high, holy thing that's unattainable, but that you're, there's a kind of vow to other and to be spacious and generous.
Thank you.
Get that guy over here to the Roman.
Richard Schwartz, your comment about the Yankee bookworm is taking some kind of inspiration from Richard Corleone. I didn't quite catch that. Who they were. And there's this thing in Civil Disobedience, an interview between Helen Adam and Allen Ginsberg, which I haven't read yet, but I'm really interested in that. The perpetuation of the ballad. And I was, who are the Yankee bookworms and what were they doing?
Well, people like Ezra Pound who picked up on Troubadour poetry. And then the whole idea that you make it new, make it new, make it new is the big slogan. But when you're making something, and what Jerry is saying is that, using Pound as an example, very often when an artist makes something new, it is with reference to history and the knowledge of where his or her art is coming from. And it's really working out something very old. So I was sort of making a leap and saying that the sung poetry of the 12th century and the 13th century inspired early modernists to begin reciting again, common breath again, and then the whole oral renaissance of poetry again, probably inspired by the Troubadour poetry that had been repopularized by people in Christian era.
Did Alan say just because cultures are different, doesn't mean one isn't superior, or doesn't mean one is superior?
It's just because there are a lot of different cultures doesn't mean that one is not superior to the other. Just because there's a lot of them doesn't mean that they're all meant to have equal value.
Great, okay, well, we're out of time. I wanted to thank you, Stephen, so much, and thank you to the art college, to the art building. It's really fun here.